This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's show, we're going to be looking at Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates, The Secret Life of Pets, Wiener Dog, Cell, and Zero Days. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
For me, it was a bit of a slow news week, and I think a lot of the reason for that is because we had 4th of July fall on a Monday, so pretty much the entire industry takes off. But there are a couple little things that popped up that I find kind of interesting. The first one is there are people up in arms over the cover story on Vanity Fair. I think it's in the Australian edition. But it's a cover story on Vanity Fair. It's an interview with Margot Robbie that apparently people are upset because they're calling it a lecherous interview, or just basically the guys doing the whole female gaze the entire time through the and not treating her like a real artist, not treating her like a real person, but objectifying her and being a Lothario through the entire interview. First of all, just look at the front cover. It's Margot Robbie in her underwear, which I have nothing wrong with. I am a big fan of Margot Robbie in her underwear. But that's what sells this magazine. I find it amazing. People are like, oh, isn't this terrible? Isn't they're demeaning to women, and we need more female journalists. Okay, let's just put on the brakes here for a second. First of all, this did not happen in a vacuum, and this did not happen because of misogyny of the journalistic people involved. This has 100% to do with people buying the issue. You put Margot Robbie in her underwear on any issue, it could be the Financial Times, and you're going to sell more copies. Second of all, it's Vanity Fair. Now, I know Vanity Fair has had a couple feathers in their cap in terms of political reporting and cultural reporting, but ultimately, it's essentially a high society magazine. It is like Harper's Bazaar. They're steeped in the fashion industry. So when you have an attractive young woman who's a rising star, you're going to get a story that's going to be talking about how attractive she is. That's what sells the magazine. What sells the magazine is not going to be Margot Robbie's thoughts on Brexit or Margot Robbie's thoughts on Black Lives Matter. Just look at Tarzan from last week. She was just a damsel in distress. She was just there to look pretty. And if you look back at when she did Focus earlier this year, she was just there to be a pretty face. She did a good job, but even in like Wolf of Wall Street, it wasn't exactly a powerhouse acting job. She was just drop dead, knock your teeth out gorgeous. This is how you get noticed when you're in your 20s and you're in Hollywood. And this has never not been how you get noticed. And in reality, that's also how you get noticed if you're a guy. You're either an absurd fool or you're a good looking guy. You know what? Honestly, if Zac Efron were profiled, he's got a movie coming out this week. So if Zac Efron were profiled on the cover of Vanity Fair, don't you think he'd get the exact same questions? This is the industry. It's sort of like when, you know, was it Glamour? They had Mila Kunis on the cover and she's like, oh, I took it with no makeup. No, she took head. You look at the cover, she has makeup on. She has makeup on and they did a ton of Photoshop. I mean, look, Mila Kunis is a good looking dame, but I imagine her waking up in the morning, she probably looks a little bit crazy, as we all do. The next piece of news that I thought was interesting is it came out, it was just dropped by, I think John Cho dropped this, is he came out and announced, I'm sure planned through the studio, to point out that Sulu, the character of Sulu in the new Star Trek movie, is gay, and apparently in the movie he has a husband and or a boyfriend or something, and has a relationship. And they bring that out in the movie, and people went crazy over this in a different way than they did the Margot Robbie story. But they're like, oh, isn't this great? You know, equality, which is great. I have gay friends. I have a lot of respect for people in the gay community. I'm not going to demean the gay community here. But this isn't exactly groundbreaking. I know why they did it. I mean, they did it because George Takei was the original Sulu, and he's gay. He's one of the most famous gay men on the planet. But it's not really all that groundbreaking to have Sulu be gay. Did anyone even know if Sulu was heterosexual in the original? I don't think they even address it. And the reason they don't address it is because he was just the guy who flew the ship. There's not a whole lot of depth in Sulu's character in those three seasons and then the whatever seven or eight movies he was in. That's nothing wrong with that. It's just he's a secondary character. If you really wanted to be progressive, you'd make Kirk or Spock gay. And in fact, if you really wanted to be progressive, you would have made Spock gay. Because they never point out, well, I guess there's a part where he goes into Pon Farr in the original TV show and he's taking a female mate or not taking a female mate. But he does kind of leave her for his bromance with Kirk. So if there's not a gay romance in Star Trek that's not Kirk and Spock, I don't know what is. This is still just sort of, it's kind of like throwing a bone. I mean, the problem is I think this is just spin control at this point. There's been just so much bad buzz for Star Trek with that trailer that they dropped and the motorcycles and the Beast Eater Boys and Rihanna that they're just saying, let's put something positive out there and get a little bit of good love from social media. And like sheep, the rest of the entire community forgets about motorcycles and Rihanna and the Beastie Boys and Justin Lin, the director, and they suddenly jump on that bandwagon. It reminds me a bit of the whole thing with Bruce Jenner and Caitlyn Jenner, the whole transition there. Bruce Jenner was a horrible kind of jerk. The entire Jenner and Kardashian family clan just makes me want to puke, and it has nothing to do with genitalia. Jenner's kind of a nut job, and a hugely insane media whore that he's distributed to his whole family. But then when the event dovetails with political correctness, he becomes, or she becomes, this champion. And I'm sorry. The publicity monster that grew out of this, I still doubt that this has a whole lot to do with identity as much as it was a piece of publicity. That's how that whole family looks at it. They're just that sleazy of a family. Again, am I calling transsexuals sleazy? No, I'm calling Bruce/Caitlyn Jenner sleazy because that's the family that he has presided over and she does preside over. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Sully, Clint Eastwood's new movie, opening on September 9th.
No one warned us. No one said you were going to lose both engines at a lower altitude than any jet in history. This was dual engine loss at 2,800 feet, followed by an immediate water landing with 155 souls on board. No one has ever trained for an incident like that.
Our job is to investigate how a plane ended up in the Hudson River.
This actually, it looks like a decent Clint Eastwood movie. His movies blow hot and cold. Some are really good. Some just are a bore. Some of them, he directs like an old man. And he's like, what, like 58,000 years old or something? This one looks interesting because it does look like it's going to be a slow burn. And it looks like it's going to be a much better story than Flight, that turd that was brought into the Academy Awards. Tom Hanks doing the Clint Eastwood thing. I'm kind of looking forward to this one. The next one I want to talk about, real interesting, isn't really a full theatrical release, but it's The Killing Joke. And it opens for a one-night-only show in theaters across the nation, and then it goes on demand on the 26th, and the DVD Blu-ray release on August 2nd.
I've been thinking about you and me. About how this is going to end. About who will end up killing who. Perhaps you'll kill me. Perhaps I'll kill you.
Tell me what I'm doing here.
You're going mad.
Where is he?
Why aren't you laughing?
All it takes is one bad day.
This is, of course, the infamous graphic novel that was published in the 80s, in which the Joker does some pretty horrible things and pretty twisted things, too. And it kind of made news because they said, we're going to adapt this to an animated film. But it's not for kids. It's a bona fide R-rated movie. It actually got an R rating from the MPAA. And kudos to them for, because if you've read the graphic novel, it is not at all PG. This looks interesting. It looks like they're authentically doing it, truthful to the source material. So this one I'm actually really looking forward to. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, let's talk about the secret life of pets and wiener dogs. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, kicking off the movie reviews. This is going to be the doggy segment. It's going to be about pets. With two wholly different movies that are for two totally different audiences. The first one is the one everyone's been hearing about, and that is The Secret Life of Pets. A dog living in New York fights with the new dog in the house and ends up on the run while the rest of the pets in the building search for him.
Max, this is Duke. He's going to be your...
Chloe, I got a bad situation.
I'm your friend, and as your friend, I gotta be honest with you. I don't care about you or your problems.
In the street. Hi, Max. Who's your new roommate?
He's gonna be gone soon. Oh, wait!
Max is gone? Where is Max?
I'm busting you out of here.
This is an animated film. It is done by Illumination Entertainment, which is the group most famous for the Minions and the Despicable Me movies. And, you know, obviously Despicable Me is a huge franchise and the Minions did extremely well and they're wanting to do more things. You know, they want every animation block wants to be like Pixar, where it's not just Toy Story, not just Cars, and not just any of these other Monsters Incorporated, Finding Dory, or anything. They want all of them. They want a whole series. They want to be able to create an entire studio with multiple franchises. So that's what The Secret Life of Pets does. And it's cute. I mean, especially, it's really definitely geared towards people who have animals. And if you are a dog person or a cat person, really, you will see behavior that they take a lot of care to make the pets do things that are very cat-like or dog-like. And it's cute. It really is. It has a great voice cast. It has Louis C.K. as the main dog. And he's good in it simply because he's such a depressing person. He's such a depressing personality. And that is a very different character than you would expect from this dog, which just looks as a little Jack Russell Terrier jumping around all excited. You would never expect his voice to come out of that. Kind of like when they did the Ice Age movies and they had John Leguizamo do the sloth and kind of be this stuttering, can't shut up character when you'd expect a sloth to be slow and deliberate. Or the Taco Bell dog from back in the 90s with the, you know, Quiero Taco Bell, that deeper Mexican voice coming out of this tiny little animal. That movie works in that way for several of the animals. One of the other, the kind of the bad guy in it is played by Kevin Hart. And he's essentially this cute little white bunny rabbit. And of course they're playing off of his obnoxious behavior and his very loud demeanor and very energetic coming out of this adorable little bunny. And that works. There's really nothing wrong with it. I mean, you can't sit there and like Angry Birds. I didn't like Angry Birds as much because it just went obnoxious all the way. This one doesn't have the real tender moments that you'd expect from something like from Pixar or even sometimes DreamWorks. But it doesn't get over the top obnoxious too much. And like I said, if you love pets, if you have animals, and even other ones, like they have a falcon in there, played by Albert Brooks, who is pretty incredible in the role. It behaves like a falcon and it does these things that are very, you can tell they spent time researching the animals and animated around these voices. In the end, it's just kind of a bit of a throwaway story. You know, it's like, was Here Comes Garfield. Do you remember the first Garfield cartoon that they ever did? The one in the 80s. It was the very first time they did a television special. The very first time they ever animated Garfield and they had Lorenzo Music do the voice. It's essentially that story. It's, you know, it's they get lost and then the other animals have to help find them. And of course they run into some tough animals on the streets. It's cute enough. There's stuff in there that grownups all get. And I took my 8-year-old and he loved it. He was a huge fan. And of course, at McDonald's, they have tie-in toys. Because I guess that's what Illumination does, because they had the Minions last summer. They had the tie-in toys, the fuzzy bunny rabbit from Kevin Hart was in, and he was all excited to get that. And then the dogs are at Target. So yeah, it's cute. It's something to take the kids to. It's not groundbreaking, but it's worth checking out. It kind of rocks. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about another dog film. This is one, do not take the kids to this one. Directed by Todd Solondz, these four stories of depression and cynicism collide, tied together by a stray wiener dog.
Hey, wiener dog.
She looks like you.
Thanks.
I'm going to Ohio tomorrow. Want to come along?
What's in Ohio?
Crystal meth.
Okay.
You need to exercise.
I walk my dog.
Exercise.
I can't.
I think it's really great that you have a new dog. What's its name?
Cancer.
Why would you name it that?
It felt right.
If you don't know who Todd Solondz is and you are curious about seeing this movie, you might want to read up a little bit about him. He is an extremely depressing filmmaker, and he really got his heyday in the 90s. He did movies like Welcome to the Dollhouse and Happiness. And I won't even tell you the story that was being portrayed in Happiness, because it's very disturbing. It's not at all about happiness. But I saw the movie and I liked it because I'm a cynical, awful SOB. And so I recommended it to my sister. And at the time, we were working at the same company. And she left a voicemail for me one morning. I came in and this was, I wish I had taped it, but I didn't have a tape. But I'm going to sort of affect the voicemail for you. This is her voicemail after I told her to watch Happiness.
Kevin, I hate you for making me watch that terrible movie.
It's not about happiness. And Wiener Dog sounds like it's a charming little story about a cute little puppy. And the puppy is cute. But like any Todd Solondz movie, it is steeped in depression and awful people and awful characters and self-loathing. One of the characters, for example, is a kid who gets this dog, and this kid's been sick, and the dad gets him this dog from the pound, and they give it no training whatsoever. They don't have any training. They don't have really any equipment to take care of the dog. They're wealthy, but they like are doing yoga and eating granola. And the kid has no concept of how to take care of a dog. And of course, the dog tears up the house and it eats what it's not supposed to. And you have a reaction that you can expect from that. But it's sort of tragic for this dog, because the family is completely ill-equipped to deal with this. And, it causes problems. And you heard in the trailer, Ellen Burstyn's character, she's this old woman on her last legs of life, and she names the dog Cancer because, you know, it just seems good, you know? I mean, that is the level, but it's incredibly sharply funny at times. Todd Solondz's stuff is very much of the 90s, and they worked in the 90s. Like I said, Welcome to the Dollhouse and Happiness both came out in the 90s. This one, even though it's out in 2016, it certainly feels like a 90s movie. Now, if you want to have the tie to Welcome to the Dollhouse, Greta Gerwig's character is the grown-up version of the little girl from Welcome to the Dollhouse. Heather Matarazzo, I think I'm saying that correctly. That's her character grown up, is played by Greta Gerwig. Of course, they look completely different. And I don't know why they didn't get Heather Matarazzo to play the role, because she's still running around doing stuff, and I've seen her in movies relatively recently. But it still works as a really cynical, dark, want-to-kill-yourself kind of comedy. I mean, it's a real risk-cutter of a movie. It is a depressing film, but it's also extremely well done. So I'm going to say that Wiener Dog rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates and Sell. There
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies. Continue with the movie reviews. Let's talk about Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates. Based on real events, two brothers take out a Craigslist ad to find dates for their sister's destination wedding and end up going with two girls who are wilder than they are.
One, two, three, get loose now.
Mom and Dad, what's going on here?
Over the years at our family gathering, you two show up and you ruin it. I want you to bring a date to your sister's wedding. We don't want you showing up stag and riling each other up.
We don't rile each other up.
We never get riled up. Oh,
no. I'm here with Mike and Dave Stengel. They are looking for dates for their sister's wedding in Hawaii.
Let's make these guys take us to Hawaii.
We're looking for nice girls.
We're going to look respectable as...
Well, we'll just stop that trailer right there. You know, a part of the thing that makes this movie work are the actors. And it's not just Zac Efron and Adam Devine. I mean, Zac Efron, he's a charming enough guy, but he's not anybody that obviously I think has been proved with like Neighbors 2 and We Are Your Friends and Dirty Grandpa. No one's clamoring and knocking people over to go see Zac Efron in movies. He's had quite a few bombs on his hands, but he's still a likable enough guy on screen. And Adam Devine has a certain fan base. I likened him, a friend of mine was, we were talking about him, and I said, he's sort of like Patton Oswalt. There are people that are huge, I mean, crazy Patton Oswalt fans. I know some of them. In fact, the guy I was talking to is a huge Patton Oswalt fan, and he's like the funniest guy on the planet. And then there's people who know who Patton Oswalt is and just think he's kind of funny. But there's a huge amount of people out there who don't know who Patton Oswalt is. And if you happen to know who Patton Oswalt is, chances are you are a pretty big fan of his. That's kind of the way Adam Devine is. He is a comedian, and he's been on a bunch of shows, most well-known for being on Modern Family right now, because that's probably the biggest show he's ever been on. He plays the guy who's having a relationship with Haley. But he's been in, like, Workaholics, and he's been in a ton of other films. He was in the Pitch Perfect movies. But I think he is kind of that fan-based comedian. Like, Patton Oswalt isn't going to be a big movie star, and I don't know whether Adam Devine is either, and part of that's just his looks, part of that's kind of the characters he plays, but he can always be the wacky neighbor. But I think they're both good, both him and Zac Efron, they have a really good chemistry together, but the real glue that holds this thing together is Aubrey Plaza and Anna Kendrick. They're very funny, and they're both good actresses. In fact, when I first saw that Anna Kendrick was in this movie, I thought she was kind of slumming it a bit. This does not seem like the kind of role she would normally play. She seems better than that. And that's not to be insulting to the film, but that's sort of the sense I got from it. But her and Aubrey Plaza do a great job. In fact, Kendrick does a great job just letting Aubrey Plaza be the wild card. It's somewhat of a generous role to do. They're not fighting for the spotlight, so to speak. And it is their sense of humor and their presence on screen that actually makes the film worth watching, all four of them together. But really, it's the girls that are the glue that holds this thing together. They're both extremely funny. I love Aubrey Plaza, but one thing that does bother me, and this is going to sound, I'm going to be lumped in with the lecherous writings about Margot Robbie, is she's just getting too skinny. It looks like you're listening too much to the press and to Hollywood, and you do the best. Being as funny as you are, it doesn't matter how small your waist is in a bikini. In fact, you could stand to gain a few pounds. But the one thing I find interesting about this movie, it's funny. It is a funny movie. It's not Wedding Crashers funny. Wedding Crashers is sort of like the gold standard of crazy wedding movies. I think this is a movie that'll be forgotten in a couple months. I mean, it'll still be one of those that you might swerve into on cable, but I don't think it's going to be like a famous movie that lives on in people's memory. And it's based on a true story. These guys really did take out an ad to go to, I think it was their cousin's wedding, but, or their niece's wedding. But, you know, obviously it's been hyped up a lot for Hollywood. The thing I find interesting is there's this sort of, you saw this in Neighbors 2, this weird anti-misogyny thing going on. And my thing I didn't like about Neighbors 2 is they were like, no, it's okay for girls to have massive anonymous sex and take painkillers and massive drugs and drink until they pass out. Isn't that awesome? Equality, woohoo! And I'm like, no, that's kind of sleazy behavior no matter who you are. It doesn't matter what genitalia you've got on your body. And in this one, they take a lot of these situations that you might have seen in a comedy in the 80s, had it been made in the 80s, and they role reverse it with the sexual roles. Like, for example, the bride in the movie has a, it's not a fling. She, delicately put, she kind of gets a pseudo happy ending at a spa treatment. And it's really glossed over eventually in the movie. And I'm like, you know what? If that was a guy, if the groom had done that, that would not have washed into the next scene as being, oh, it's okay. And there's another scene in there where one of the characters, the brothers, they have a lesbian cousin. So she's out there hitting on everybody. I guess I think in the movie she's bisexual. So she's hitting on literally everybody, man or woman. And she gets a little bit of action from Aubrey Plaza's character. And her the whole reasoning for it was to get backstage passes to Rihanna. And again, it's just sort of brushed away. And I'm like, oh, that's fine. You know, it seems somewhat innocuous, but I'm like, what would have happened if you would have role reversed that at this point in their relationship? If that was a guy doing it to a girl, or if it was the guy and she was, Aubrey Plaza's character was doing something to the guy, it would be a little different. And I find that interesting that there is that standard out there, this new sort of neo-feminism of we're equal, but we still want to be treated different. And I'm all for equality. I want equality in treatment. And if it doesn't work by reversing the roles, then it still doesn't work and there's not equality. And just because it cuts in your favor doesn't mean that you get a cheer, rah, rah, isn't this great? You're still working in an unlevel playing field, and you should be for equality and not for inequality that just benefits you. I don't think there was that much depth of thought put into this movie, though, so let's just skip that. Anyways, I have to say that in the end, Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Cell. Based on Stephen King's bestseller, John Cusack stars as a man trying to survive in a world when a mysterious signal over cell phones turned people into violent crazies.
Hi, Dad.
Hey, buddy.
Are you coming home?
Yeah. Soon.
Okay.
It's terrorists, right? It's gotta be terrorists.
Don't use your cell phone.
We're gonna survive because people are gonna die.
They may be the next stage in human evolution. What's happening now is more than temporary anarchy. It's a start of a war.
This is, I think, the last Stephen King book I read. It's sad to say, but once Stephen King stopped drinking, his books became uninteresting to me. Because when he finally came out and said that he had stopped drinking, and I remember reading about it years later and saying, oh yeah, that's when his books kind of started to suck. So his best stuff he did when he was an alcoholic. And that's great that he got his stuff together. But this was done in 2006. He was more on the sober wagon at that point. But I thought it was still a decent book. It was one of his last really good ones that I had any interest in reading. Originally, Eli Roth was going to do it. And I didn't know if he would do a good job. It's possible he wouldn't have, because the guy can't make a coherent movie. He just does scenes. So it's kind of interesting to see this movie. Now, it's out on demand, but it's got a theatrical run this week. And I'm sad to report it's not very good. And it's kind of sad because it's got John Cusack and Samuel L. Jackson in it. And they both were in 1408, which was one of his movies. It was actually really pretty good. It's one of the last good Stephen King movie that came out. I'm not talking TV. I'm talking about the movies themselves based on his original books. You had that 2007, 2008 when 1408 and The Mist came out. And then after that, there really hasn't been anything that's really garnered any attention. A lot of his stuff's going direct to video or nowhere. He did A Good Marriage a couple years ago, and I thought it was kind of an okay movie, but it's sort of sad. I mean, I remember back when a Stephen King movie was an event, and now it's just a choice on your on-demand roulette wheel. The problem with this one is it's way too low rent, and the directing's just shabby and boring, and the characters are kind of murky, and there's elements to the book that made it a little odd, but it kind of made it interesting. Those are all gone, and it's just a very straightforward movie that sort of hints at a couple things that were explored a little greater in the book. But other than that, it's not very good at all. And it's just sad and disappointing. That's kind of what it felt like watching this movie for me. So I'm going to have to say that Cell kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for the segment. When I come back, I'm going to do a review of 0 Days, talk about the box office, and talk about the home cinema roundup. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's finish up these movie reviews with 0 Days. This documentary examines the origin and purpose of the Stuxnet virus and how the digital world may be the new medium for international warfare.
Why can't we talk more openly and publicly about Stuxnet?
Two answers before we even get started. I don't know, and if I did, we wouldn't talk about it anyway.
It spread to any Windows machine in the entire world. We didn't know if it was set to turn off all electricity plants around the world or it would launching some attack. This is not your ordinary criminal doing this. This is someone bigger.
This has the whiff of August 1945. Somebody just used a new weapon, and this weapon will not be put back into the box.
I remember when the Stuxnet virus happened, and I mean, I really wasn't paying that close attention to it. I didn't read in-depth stories. But I do remember, and it was kind of a big deal. What was neat about this movie is the guy who does it, it has some big flaws in it in terms of he tries to do a bit of a narrative in some ways, almost like a Michael Moore kind of narrative dropped in at times, and it just doesn't work. He doesn't have the same flair that Moore has. And at one time, he brings in an actor to basically read the testimony of somebody under a cloak so that you wouldn't know who it is, and the actor's awful. The actor is just terrible, and it sounds like somebody reading fake testimony. Where it really works is setting up the timeline of events. Now, what makes a movie like 0 Days so difficult is it's about hacking and malware. And that stuff is incredibly boring, especially in a movie, to be realistic. I mean, this isn't like Hackers or Black Hat or even War Games, where you got screens and somebody sitting there, you know, looking cool and bleep, bloop, bloop. Oh, look, I hacked into the Pentagon in 3 minutes kind of thing. Hacking and programming and coding is extremely boring work, especially for somebody who's not into that sort of thing. And the movie manages to explain what Stuxnet did and explain why it is significant and why it's not just another piece of malware. And the sweeping ramifications that something like this has, and the reality that we're living in a world where this stuff can be developed by nation states rather than just a couple hackers in Russia trying to get your credit card. It also manages to frame all this in a global perspective and deal with the sometimes very tenuous politics of US and Israel and Iranian and Russian and North Korean relations that we all just know peripherally from reading the news and watching reports and seeing the crap that people post on their Facebook page. It actually frames it in a completely understandable and at times very chilling manner because you realize what this means. Now, some of it's overstated. You know, they're talking about it being the Hiroshima event. I wouldn't say that Stuxnet was a Hiroshima event because a million people didn't die as a result of the bomb. Stuxnet didn't take out a nation or end a war. I think people are more relating it to Hiroshima is because that's when the world had it first unleashed on them. I remember when I worked at a tech company back in the 90s when the Explorer.zip virus hit. Now, beforehand, there was a a virus that was passed through email that what it did, all it did was just email itself to people on your email list, on your like address book. It did nothing malicious. It just emailed itself. And I remember when that happened and people are like, oh, wow. I they got caught off guard because they just replied to an email or they opened an email. And all that was setting the groundwork for the Explorer.zip virus, which was a virus that would then erase your hard drive and mail itself to everybody in your address book. And what it did is it had a zip file that looked like a zip file, but it said .exe. So essentially people would get an email and it came from somebody they knew. And then you'd open it and it would wipe out your hard drive. I remember I worked at a high level tech company at the time. And when that happened, because it didn't just wipe out your computer, people had network drives and then it wiped out the drives. And fortunately, a lot of people had backups and stuff, but I knew people who got stung with that virus. The email virus was the splitting of the atom for the first time. Explorer.zip was the Hiroshima. So Stuxnet is really more of the splitting of the atom. What comes after Stuxnet is what you got to be worried about. And that's what this does talk about. And it flip-flops around from talking about data channels for espionage and warfare to real life politics to nuclear proliferation. But it's a very interesting movie. It's definitely worth seeing if for anything to just make you paranoid about the future and turning on your computer or turning on your coffee maker for that matter. But yes, Zero Day is definitely worth checking out. It's really good. It totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Was I correct last week? I said that Finding Dory was going to make $40 million. Finding Dory made $42 million over the three-day. When you take into account the four-day weekend, it was over 50, which is still fantastic numbers for Finding Dory. I mean, that puts it, I think it's going into this weekend with over $400 million. It's a massive hit. Not much more you can really say about that. The thing that I found interesting was The Legend of Tarzan, which I remember saying was going to be struggling, and a lot of the tracking was saying it was going to be in the 20s. Now, The Legend of Tarzan came in with just under $40 million for the three-day and with about $46, $47 million for the four-day. What's interesting is that was being reported as a surprise overperforming bit of a hit. And I did step back for a minute and say, wait a minute. How is it that Legend of Tarzan, which cost probably $15 million more than Independence Day Resurgence, how is that making less in the three-day than the previous week when Independence Day made just over $40? How is that being reported as a hit and Independence Day being reported as a bomb? And this is something I've talked about before. It's not about how much it makes. It's not even about how much it makes in relation to how much it cost. It is how much it makes in relation to how much people expected it to make. In particular, the studios expected it to make. That is why Avengers Age of Ultron could be considered a bit of a disappointment when it opens with $190 million and ends up making over $500 million. It just didn't make the $600 million that they were expecting that Avengers did. It's the same reason why Batman versus Superman can be, at this point, the number four highest grossing movie worldwide and have made $330 million domestically and still be considered a disappointment because people are saying, well, the other Batman movies made this should make $200 million easy for opening weekend. It didn't, and that's okay. So you always have to take these box office reports with a grain of salt because Independence Day isn't doing as poorly as some people want you to believe and Legend of Tarzan isn't doing as well as people want you to believe. They're still going to struggle and they probably neither one is going to make even close to their budget in America. They're going to heavily rely on foreign receipts. This week, Secret Life of Pets going to win. I don't think anyone's debating that. It's definitely going to do more than what Finding Dory is going to do, which is probably going to be 20-some million over the weekend, and it's not even going to be bothered by Mike and Dave. That's R-rated, and it doesn't have any like really kind of stars to it. I mean, Zac Efron doesn't count now. And so let me look for like low teens for that movie over the weekend. The thing with The Secret Life of Pets is it is in competition. All the stuff Disney's done, Disney has been ruling the marketplace. You had a short blip with Angry Birds, but pretty much you had this undying run of Zootopia, Then you had Jungle Book. Then you had Finding Dory. And these movies are all doing extremely well, and it's how much competition they are still going to provide against Secret Life of Pets. I mean, I've seen people saying in the 80s, I'm going to give a soft, very conservative $65 million prediction for Secret Life of Pets. We'll see what it ends up. I mean, if it comes in under that, that's going to be considered a disappointment because everybody's projecting higher. Remember what I said just previously. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Couple ones to highlight: Only Yesterday, which is a new Studio Ghibli movie. It's kind of flew under the radar. It's not Hayao Miyazaki, and that's kind of, I think, why it's flying under the radar. There's also Cabin Fever, which is the remake that's out from Shout Factory. Not as good as the Eli Roth original, and actually that's one of his few good movies that he's done. But, you know, hey, if you want to see Cabin Fever done slightly differently, you can check out Cabin Fever. There's also By the Sea, which was terrible, the one directed by Angelina Jolie, starring her husband as a couple, and their relationship's imploding. Boy in the World, that's an interesting film. It was an animated movie, nominated for an animation Oscar, runs a little long just because of the template and the style. Doesn't lend itself to long form filmmaking, but it's definitely a neat movie to check out. And then a couple other ones I saw the light: the story of Hank Williams, The Mermaid, which is that massive grossing movie from China, House of Cards Season 4, Term Life, and The Adderall Diaries. That's it for this week. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Ghostbusters and The Infiltrator. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.